Welcome to the Scottish Football Coaching Podcast, taking you around the country, shedding light on the work of the Scottish FA from grassroots to coach development, and taking a look at the future of our game.
In a first for the Scottish Football Coaching Podcast, basketball star Kieran Akara sits down with your host Lewis Irons and Greg Patterson from the Scottish FA to discuss his career in basketball.
Another edition of the Scottish Football Coaching Podcast, but today it's a little less football. Greg and I are joined by Kieran Akara. Kieran, thank you so much for joining us from isolation at the moment. I know it's tricky, but it's really great to have you on the podcast. Big Kieran, as we should call you.
Big Kieran, well, thanks for having me. I'm excited to be on. Like I said, it's a break from reality.
Greg, it is a different branch of the podcast we're going to go down today. One that I know, as we were just speaking beforehand, that you and I are definitely intrigued to get into here, going into Kieran's career and touching on the side of basketball, which is going to be great to hear.
I think it's always important that I always use the analogy of looking over a fence, and I think it's always important to look over that fence and look and see what different sports are getting and what can we learn. So you're not embroiled just in football all the time. And Kieran's got some great stories. I know he spent a bit of time with Malky Mackay, and it was always Malky that was saying to me, you need to get in touch with Kieran, you need to get Kieran involved, he's got some good stories. And I know Kieran's keen to learn from different sports as well, and is open-minded in that way. So it'll be great to hear, as you say, Lewis, it'll be great to hear what he's taken from football, and of course what football can take from his experience in basketball. And of course, I think it's the first Olympian. And well, I know it's the first Olympian we've ever had on.
Could well be the last as well. You know, it's a pleasure, and it really is great to have you, Kieran, a man of your stature in the sport and the Olympics. It's going to be great to really get into it. But before we do, personally, how are you getting on with everything going on? I know you mentioned your wife's a nurse. She must be doing an incredible amount of work at the moment. So I'm sure a lot happening in your household.
Yeah, it's just obviously it's uncertainty is probably the biggest killer. It's, you know, my wife going back to work, there was a fear factor. You know, how's she going to be? How's things going to be? And it was very quiet at the start, and then it picked up a little bit. And it's, you know, even the tasks they're getting asked to do, it's so out of the ordinary. There's a lot of stress there. So trying to help her through that is quite demanding. But then I've got my children at home too. I've got a little 13-month-year-old and a 5-year-old daughter, and honestly, I am so tired. I've never been like, I would do anything. I've set up for every single volunteer group there is. I just want out. It's just a different world, you know. But at the same time, I was so used to it. I just retired last year, and just having the opportunity to spend some quality time with family is something that, you know, I'll never take for granted again.
Yeah, it's true, isn't it? I think a lot of people have been talking about that in general, Greg. It's a time that people, particularly in sport, don't really get a lot of time off with the travelling involved and everything that comes with it. So it is a blessing in many ways for family time, but obviously challenging as well.
It's an amazing amount of people, little things like Kieran's described there, and it's amazing. I think, without exaggerating, I've spoke to 3 or 4 people that are involved in football recently, and they've said, I taught my kid to ride their bike this week. Yeah. You know, and if it wasn't them at home, it was probably their wife or their uncle or something like that would have taught the kid and said, so you're right, those moments that were not normally afforded are valuable at this point in time.
Yeah. I guess, Kieran, if we look at your career then, I'm sure we'd like to go back to the kind of start for you, early days of playing basketball. What are your earliest memories of playing the sport and taking it on?
Well, I always describe it as, you know, I was just your typical 6'10" black Scottish guy. You know, my life was... No, but in all honesty, I started basketball really late. I was like 14, 15. Obviously, coming from Scotland, it's not a sport anyone played. If you look at me, you think basketball, but believe it or not, I played football. Yeah. I played for Cars Thistle, believe it or not, through in Stirling. I did lawn bowls. I tried a little bit of rugby, but my chicken legs weren't built for that. But I just enjoyed sport, and I loved playing multiple sports. And then I got into the school team at 15, and we went on and won the Scottish Cup. And my career just, honestly, it went so fast from there. So it just completely changed my mindset. So before, I was just playing for fun. I went over to a camp in the States for basketball. Prince's Trust gave me a scholarship. Got to a camp over in America, and a coach put his arm around me and told me, son, if you work really, really hard, you could get a scholarship. I had no idea what a scholarship was at that time. As soon as I found out what it was and the opportunities I could get, my whole mindset changed. I just had a different purpose. So I was just driven from there. So everything I did from that point on was to achieve that goal. and thankfully that ended up happening. I went over to Pittsburgh on a full scholarship when I was a little bit older.
Yeah, we touched on just before starting this, Greg, the way that Americans do things. The American sports are incredible. We've spoke on this podcast, of course, about United Soccer conventions and the game over there, but basketball in the States, what a level that's at.
Oh, it was unreal, and it was crazy because I actually did a year of high school in Middlesbrough before going over to America. There was a basketball academy there. It was done through their school system, and one of the guys at the school with me, he was on he played for Middlesbrough at football. And when my basketball coach came over to recruit me, he ended up going back to Pittsburgh and telling the coach of the football team, soccer team, I'm going to say soccer just to keep it. And he told him that there was a football team there as well. So he then came over and recruited a little guy called Scott Gibson, who's now with the Riverhounds. He's got his own academy there. So he came over with me at the time, and it was so funny because it was like a role reversal, because when I was in Middlesbrough, the football team with the women and everything, it was just, they were just surrounded. No one cared about basketball. And then when we went over to America, they were nationally ranked. They were in the top 20, and Duquesne were top 20 in the nation for football, but they were only getting like 250 people at their games, while we were getting thousands, you know, and we were terrible. So it was quite ironic in a way, but enjoyable at the same time.
Yeah, Greg, I guess when the opportunity came up to get Kieran on the podcast, you must have been thinking this is an opportunity to really show the similarities, but of course, learning experiences from a different sport.
Definitely, and I mean, I was fortunate enough. I did my third year at university over at Clemson, and I've kind of seen what Kieran, you know, is explaining there. You know, I remember one day, you know, in the soccer team, as Kieran rightly calls it, you're in the soccer team and you're maybe getting 500 people along at a lovely purpose-built stadium. And I thought, I'll go along at a basketball game. What do you mean you'd go along? You can't get tickets. You know, you have to queue for hours. You have to queue for hours just to get a ticket. So you're right, there's all that side of it, but there's, you know, there's just that side of it as well. It's, you know, the experiences that Kieran will have, you know, been through, the people that he'll have worked with, and the learnings that we've got from all that, I think are just so cross-transferable, those, and it's just so valuable to football coaches as well. It's interesting, you know, you think about the likes of, remember Roy Keane was a little bit different when he was doing his pro licence. I think he went and spent time with the All Blacks rather than going to a football team. You know, so people, as I said before, I think it's good to think out the box, and as you say, Kieran's a great guest to help us do that.
Yeah, and then of course over there, university basketball must be quite an experience, Kieran, was it?
Yeah, it definitely was, but the biggest learning point for me, so when I first went over to America, I couldn't even do one press-up, to be fair. You know, I was always growing up, you know, at my time it was growing up, if you did weights or whatever, you wouldn't grow. That was kind of the mindset. Then I go over to university, or actually I did another year of high school, that's another story, in the States. And the strength and conditioning programs we were on were unreal. But then even when my basketball coach was saying, okay, you're talking about my running gait. So then he had me working with the athletics coach. And you know, I still played with the football team every summer. I did training, still soccer, football every summer. Did the Cooper test, the 2 mile runs, everything else. So all the sports were used to working together, and I thought it was such something that was really, really big. Something I took for granted, because when I was first growing up, it was, you know, you dedicated yourself to something and you stuck with that. But in America, it was the way it was set up, it was very seasonal. So It wasn't about producing the best soccer player or basketball player or, you know, American football player. It was producing the best athlete. And then later on in life, that's when they really started to focus on the skill set and everything else to be. So once they chose that sport, they wanted to go down. So it was really interesting to see. I saw an article of the coach Urban Meyer at the time at Ohio State. Said he would never recruit an American football player who only had played American football. He wanted that kind of mix, that kind of eclectic understanding, because there's things that become natural. You kind of add your extra flair from it, what you learn from other sports. And I took that seriously, because I think a lot of the, like, my footwork and everything came from football.
Yeah,
I was late to basketball, so there was a lot of things that I was picking up from other sports that I then transferred to my basketball later on in life.
That's quite something, isn't it, Greg, to absorb in
It's remember Marvin Bartley with Marvin on, and Marvin, you know, he was late to the game of football. You know, he was, he talked about cricket and different things, didn't he, as a youngster, and only started taking football seriously maybe when he was 16. Yeah. So Caden's done similar for basketball, and just as he's chatting there, it reminded me of a story of Arsene Wenger. I remember the year Arsenal went undefeated, you know, that season, and I remember the BBC, what do they call it, the end of season thing, the kind of sports personality of the year.
Yeah.
Gary Lineker going to Arsene Wenger, and they obviously showed a highlights reel of that Arsenal team that went undefeated, and he turned to Arsene and he said, a fantastic group of footballers you had, and he said, no one ever had a fantastic group of athletes that were fortunate enough to be good at football. So he corrected Gary Lineker straight away, right from the outset there. And I think that's what Kieran's alluding to there. You know, they were athletes first, but they were very good at football.
Very much so. Very much so.
That must play, obviously, then a huge part for your career that followed Kieran as well. That grounding and base, like I think you used the word eclectic mix.
Yep. That's
a perfect way of probably describing it. And it must have set you up in good stead for what followed.
Well, like I said, when it comes to time on task in the actual sport of basketball, I was miles behind so many. You know, kids are starting, you know, you talk about sports now, 7, 8 years old. I never really touched the basketball till I went to school, and I never thought about taking it kind of seriously till I was like 15, 16. But the holistic approach to that, so what can I do? You know, I really worked on the IQ aspect of things. You know, I made sure that my body was right. I was flexible enough, supple enough. My fitness was always at the top of its game. Those are things I could completely control. And that's that whole athlete mindset opposed to just the basketball player. Because a lot of people I know, they're happy to kick a ball around, do this, do that, but they're not willing to put the work in with the stretching, the prehab, you know, the recovery sessions. And in the long run, that's where injury happens, burnout happens, all the rest of it. So it's kind of getting that balance. So I think I was very fortunate that I'd already had experiences in other sports that allowed me to kind of be a little bit more diversified when it came to my basketball career.
Specifically with football, Greg, do you think that's maybe something that's not quite drilled into enough, that up here can dictate the rest of it? Like Kieran talks about, you know, being supple, the rehab, everything about it.
Do you know what's interesting? Just when he was chatting about that kind of stretching and prehab there, that what's quite interesting is I've been fortunate enough over the last year or so to go along to a few Glasgow Rocks games when Kieran was still playing as well. And it's a great day out for the family. But that aside, what's really interesting is before the second half starts, the whole team come out together and do a warm-up again together, just as if it's the start of the game. So in football, traditionally, that only happens at the start of the game.
Yep.
In basketball, they do it both at the start of the game and at the start of the second half. But Kieran, you'll be able to tell me better, but I know that's probably because you've got a higher rotation of players during the first half, but there must be benefits to that as well.
Yeah, well, we all actually, a lot of the games, so if you look in from a basketball perspective, there's a lot of teams that kind of, the start of the third quarter are really kind of flat.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of it's, you know, from the scientific research is because of that. You know, our mindset is more, we need to be prepared, kind of getting that kind of rhythm up for the second half, just like we were for the first half. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah.
So we believe that sometimes if you're just sitting around and you might come out flat, in a game of basketball, every possession really counts. You know, it's such a fast-paced game. So it's making sure that we're ready for that speed when we come to that. So I guess it's like a runner. You know, they kind of do their little warm-up run and then they kind of get into it, opposed to just going straight away. So from an injury prevention standpoint, it's kind of easing back in to get ready for the second half and giving all you've got. But it's really, you see that from a football perspective. When I was in the States, same thing. Half time during that break, there was a lot of guys in the changing rooms who were still doing things to keep them going, to get them ready for that second half as well. So it is quite an interesting way of taking it. It's maybe more of a cultural thing, opposed to, I guess it's the same, you know, we talk about, we used to do the kind of stagnant stretches before games. And now a lot of people are going to more kind of active, you know, active stretches.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's just a shift in dynamics and a change in culture.
Yeah, fascinating, because when I think about that and I think about the famous stories of like a Sir Alex Ferguson grilling at halftime, I don't picture the dressing room stretching and jogging.
Getting ready. Well, you're probably ducking and diving.
I picture
football
heads down. Exactly. I picture heads down, trying not to make eye contact, just taking it. But it's a fascinating insight, Greg, though, isn't it?
It's super, and that's why it's so important to learn from those other sports, you know. And I know there are, you know, you think about football. I'm back to football again, but you know, if there's let's say a couple of subs coming on at half time, then you know, sometimes the sports scientist or you know the assistant coach or whatever's out there at half time warming those guys up.
Yeah.
Sometimes all the subs are outside on the pitch at half time. Sometimes the manager or the head coach wants all the players in at halftime in the dressing room to listen to the tactics that might, you know, that might come into play in the second half. So, as Kieran says, it's maybe horses for courses and different ways to do things. But as I say, there's definitely learning between sports to happen.
There is. There's plenty we're going to touch on as the podcast continues here. Kind of want to move, of course, into the professional side of things, Kieran. I know your career took you Italy first, wasn't it? And, of course, you played in Spain and Greece. But Italy in particular was that first step. How was that transition?
Italy for me was a complete eye opener.
Yeah.
Because in America, I always said the thing I learned the most in America was to compete. So when I was in Scotland, I was very humble, and I think I remained humble through my career. But say if a coach had told me in Scotland that I was coming off the bench, for example, not a starter, I would accept that and to accept my role, still give my role its absolute best, but I would accept my role and that's it. In America, no one ever accepted the role. Like everyone wanted to be a starter. So every single day at practice, someone was coming for your spot. So it's very hard in a team sport to have that balance between the individual and the team. But the American mindset was, if you're pushing yourself to your absolute limits for that spot, you're also pushing your teammate. So therefore, the team will then benefit. So when I was in America, it was compete, compete, compete. Great fitness, great this, great that. But then when I went to Europe, it completely changed them. It was more about the whole tactical side of the game. Okay. So that's where the coach was so, so important. While in America, it was all about the recruiting and then helping the athletes become the biggest, strongest, fastest they can be.
Yeah.
In Europe, it was all about the development tactically to understand the team concepts to get the right kind of movement. So I was learning, it was like learning a completely new game. But at the same time, the Italian fans, from a basketball perspective, so I was in Bologna. If you look up, I'll let you look up later on, but it's called the Fossa di Leone. It was at Ultras.
Oh, yeah.
They were banned from Bologna football games originally. And came to the basketball. So now you've got all the. Obviously, there wasn't a fan base then, so it was just they were accepting anybody.
Yeah.
So all of a sudden, you've got these crazy fans, ultras with the flares, everything, and you're indoors. And it was just madness. Like, I remember one game they tried to have cheerleaders. The fans were just throwing like things at them because they like to sing, do everything like it's like a football game, but it's a small arena, you know, like 6,000, 7,000 packed every single game. So I was trying to adjust to these fans as well, but I think the Scottish in me, they play me the kind of passion, the fans just kind of really latched onto that. But yeah. My head hurt after every training session because I was learning so many new concepts and you have to learn them so fast. So we would have like 7 to 10 plays we were learning a day and it was just, I had to start learning patterns opposed to trying to take it all in, because once you started to understand the patterns and the whys, opposed to just looking at the whole play, it became a lot easier for me. But that was a learning curve. It took me a good 2 or 3 months to kind of get into that rhythm.
Yeah, I can imagine. And I don't know about you, Greg, but the tactical side of a sport like basketball fascinates me. Like we're kind of embedded in the tactical side of football, but basketball, there's, I mean, from an outsider looking in, there must be so much intricate sort of work that goes into the tactical side of basketball.
There really is, and I get a little flavour of it doing a sports degree. And, you know, Kieran said that hurt his... I think he used the phrase that it hurt his head after training. It used to hurt my head as well, and I'm not... That was nowhere near the level he's talking about. You know, I remember... Funny, it takes me back to... I remember Jimmy Sinclair. I remember being a development officer, and we were all at large, as we used to be, with the Scottish FA. And Jimmy Sinclair, who was the technical director of whatever role he was fulfilling at the time. And Greece, I don't know if you remember Greece when they won, I can't remember what year that would have been, Greece when they won the European Championship. Yeah, I
remember that.
2004, was it?
Even, when?
2004?
No, it wasn't that recent, was it? Well, it might have been. We're now 2020, so it might have been. So, but Jimmy went over to study Greece and have a look at what they were doing. And of course, basketball's big in Greece. So he thought there was a kind of cross transferable. If you remember, Greece used to win free kicks high up the pitch, and then it was all the plays, and I think they scored 90% of their goals or whatever. They won most games 1-0 during that championship. So it was like exactly what Kieran's describing there. It was like, let's win free kicks high up the pitch, and let's have set different plays depending on what side the free kick's on or whatever. And bloody hell, they won a European championship out of it.
But mix,
because
it?
Basketball's big in that country, that worked for them.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm sure, Kieran, you've talked about from the side of things that you picked up in the States, the mental side, that side of game, tactical side you're picking up. Your career must have been shaping up quite well at that point in terms of everything you were picking up from the coaches and the teams you were playing for.
Well, once I got that point and I continued with that American kind of competitiveness mindset, because that's where I say that's where I learned my confidence.
Yeah.
I really learned to step up and challenge in a certain way. Don't get me wrong, there is a way to challenge.
Yeah.
But then when I went to Italy, that was, all that learning kind of took place, because now it wasn't just about being just chasing it. I became more efficient. I could pick and if people talk about my career, they always talk about my IQ. I started to think like a coach.
Yeah.
It was easy for me to kind of process things that way. And that is my advice for a lot of young athletes is a lot of the time, everyone talks about the why right now and why we're doing certain things. They don't understand how much video coaches actually watch. So when coaches start to give their scout, they're forgetting that the players haven't watched as much video as they have.
Yeah.
So sometimes they get to a point and they understand and say, we're going to do this, that, and the next thing. But they don't really kind of get a grip of why they're doing that. Yeah. Once I started to understand why I'm doing certain things, things become a lot more efficient for me, a lot easier to pick up and process. And that, I could still... So what my advice was from a coaching perspective was to kind of break down the point of why they got to that decision in the first place.
Yeah.
And really kind of harp on that, because once you understand why the decision's made, it was a lot easier to pick things up and challenge a certain way. Sometimes a player will say, well, actually, why don't we just go with it? And you can learn a lot from that as well, so having that kind of two-way kind of conversation. So I started to have that kind of more coaching mindset, kind of driving that, and just my game just came on so much. And I think that balance between, because I always talk about the European players, very high IQ, but when it came to like strength and speed, and they had nothing on the Americans, but if you look at the NBA players who came from Europe who then go over to America, they turn into these all-star players, because they've now got that kind of confidence, that I call it swagger, plus now they've got this the strength and speed. It's just a game changer. But I mean, they have the IQ, so that, to me, everything complements. There's not one correct system for me. I think it's kind of bringing it all together and making it work for you.
That's a lesson and a message that can certainly transcend sports, Craig, isn't it? That can be incorporated into any sport, I would imagine.
Absolutely. And I love the kind of term, the IQ. We would probably call that game intelligence in football. I think that's, the similar phraseology, if you like, that IQ and working on a player's... You often hear that, people that work in the talent ID side of the game in football talking about, oh, his game intelligence isn't great. But, Kieran's talking there about, his own IQ. The other thing I love is, he's talking about the American model there. And although they're very, very driven, and having been over there myself, they are very, very driven to be good, it's still practice. I just love the connotation of that word, practice. I just think we always call it training in this country. I'm going to training, and I just think the word itself, oh, I need to go to training, sounds like a bloody like graft. Whereas in America, hey man, I'm going to training. I'm going to practice. And it just sounds so much better. It just sounds, it should be enjoyable. But as Kieran says, there's an absolutely underlying message there that they'll work hard when they go to practice.
You can tell he's been to America, can't you, Kieran, with a wee hey man that was dropped in there. That was nice.
Oh, no, honestly, a lingo, but see, that was my thing when I first came home. Some of the words I was coming out, like, what am I doing? Like, I went to a little Catholic university, and my roommate, like I was telling you, going from Middlesbrough, his dad was from Govan, and then there was a wee priest for Kirkintilloch. So I kind of I clung on to that, and that's I think that's why I was allowed to keep some of my accent. But honestly, I'd be saying pants instead of trousers and stuff. Just
oh, Pennies, leather bibs, cleats, all that kind of stuff.
Cleats.
Cleats, of course. And then, of course, you did come back to Scotland for the first of a few stints with the Rocks, didn't you? And was that a nice moment getting to come back and get to play again here?
So originally, I first came back at a little stint because I knew I wasn't going to sign late when I went to Greece. No, it was Italy. But in 2012, I came back after the Olympics because in my mind, like if I look at my career, I went to university. That was my number one goal, getting education. I never thought of going professional, really, at that time. Because, again, it was I was from Scotland. Yeah. I played basketball. But then we found that they were going to have the Olympics. And I knew the only way I could make the Olympic team would be to be professional. So my pathway was kind of different to most. Like, my education was always at the forefront, and then everything else kind of followed. But I just, every goal I kind of set for myself, I just kept on smashing them. So in 2011, I was actually cut from the GB team.
Yeah.
And, I did what every guy did. I went home and cried to my mum. Yeah. And I thought that was it, because my goal was, in my mind, it was over. But mum whipped me into shape, and she told me, like, think about this, think about that. And thankfully, I made the team. But after I made the Olympics, it was like this big come down, because I was thinking, well, what's next? Like, that's it, you know? Yeah. So I was like, okay, I'm gonna go home to Scotland, and I'm probably gonna retire. But I always said I'd finish my career in Scotland.
Yeah.
So started playing a little bit. I was enjoying it, but then I just realised that no, I still want more. And so I talked with the coach. I was going to sign a long term deal with the Rocks. That ended up falling through, and I was like, okay, I'm out. So I ended up signing in Greece. Yeah. So it was kind of in my mind, it changed. I kind of appreciated the game more because, you know, at first I thought I was only doing it for the Olympics, and then I realised, no, I actually still love this. I love the competitive edge. I love what I'm doing over in Europe. So I just continued playing. So, but I was playing with a different kind of motivation then. It was more appreciation for the sport opposed to just playing the destination was the Olympics. But the reality wasn't about the destination at all. It was that whole journey. I just enjoyed every part of that.
Yeah. I'm going to come to the Olympics in a wee minute and talk about that a little bit more. But Greg, that drive that Kieran's talking about there, you know, build up thinking it's the Olympics is the main goal, achieve that, want more. That's got to be part of anyone that wants to be successful with mindset.
It's unbelievable, isn't it, listening to him, you know, and that, you know, the way he set those targets for himself, but yet the ambition he had to go and, as you say, drive on and beat those targets, and then, you know, well, to use his phrase, smash those targets, and then when you actually do get that big one, well, what the hell's next and what do I do? But, you know, it's just lovely to hear about somebody that just loved playing the sport. That, you know, and that's often said, isn't it, in coaching spheres as well. It's that intrinsic desire for the athlete to, you know, sometimes it's not the extrinsic stuff, it's not the trophies, and it's not the money, but it's got to be that intrinsic motivation that they must have within them. You know, and Malky again, I'll use him again. Malky keeps talking about that rage to master. You've got to have that rage to master within you. Otherwise, it just might not happen.
I want to go to that point you're talking about there, Kieran, where 2011, the year before the Olympics, you're cut from the team. I mean, that's a short window to then turn things around. So you went back home, you had that moment with your mum that you spoke about. That year must have been huge for you in terms of trying and working and going through so much to get into that team.
It was a real weird year because my first part of my mindset was to blame.
Yeah.
So I started to blame my coach. He doesn't like me. I was blaming, you know, this, blaming that. I never actually looked at myself. And that year, I dropped a league. I went to play in the second league in Italy, to play a more of a starring role. But what I realised in that year was I had a good season. But if I looked at my squad, the starting five compared to the second five, and that was the difference between Serie A and Liga 2. In Serie A, the 10 or 12 players in your team, any one of them could have been a starter. You know, it was just competitive every single day. When you dropped a league, the big money went to the top five players and then everything else, we just kind of made up the numbers. So then when I was at training, it was like a false sense of security. So I was dominating every single day at training, but really my competition wasn't like it was before.
Yeah.
So I think when I went to the GB camp, I had this confidence, but it was kind of fake because it was based on me playing against weaker players. So now when I was playing against stronger competition, it took me a little bit longer to adapt. And I think that's when I got, you know, so looking back at it, I wasn't in the best shape of my life that year because I didn't have to be. So I changed everything. But the one big thing I did, and it was actually my mum that forced me to do it, was to phone up my coach and ask him, well, I've been cut, I understand that. What do I need to work on to be back on this team? And he gave me a couple of pointers, and one was improve my three-point shot. So if I look at my career, everyone always talks about me being a big man who could shoot the three-point shot. I never shot the three-point shot until 2012. So when I signed in Spain that year, and that was my biggest contract that I ever signed in the sense of it was the biggest league I'd ever played in. But I took a huge pay cut to play in the top league for that reason, because I believed that I'd position myself. I knew I'd be playing against the world's best. That year, the NBA lockout was on. Yeah. So there was no NBA. So all the top players were coming back to Spain.
Yeah.
So it was super competitive. But the one thing I said to my coach before starting in Spain was, look, I know why you signed me, but would you be willing to help me improve my three-point shot? And that was before, after training. And he did that, and I owe him everything. He was the assistant coach in the Spanish team at the time. But I did so much extra work that I actually shot the best I'd ever shot from three. My percentage was through the roof. I shot such a high percentage that when I went to GB camp the following year, I didn't even care if I got cut. I was so proud of myself for the work I put in, and I realised that even if I didn't make the team, my life wasn't over. You know, before I put everything into this one goal, but now I've given it everything I had. So my thought process was like, I've given everything, I've got no excuses. If I don't make it, I don't make it, but I know life goes on, I can continue to build and work on other things. So that's when my resilience, like I said, an extra confidence, I wasn't scared to make mistakes anymore. Yeah. So I think that experience really, really helped me going forward. And the one thing I understood was not be scared to ask for help. That's a huge thing.
See, when you ask about that kind of thing, you know, you tell the story there, speaking to the coach, the head coach, to ask him if he's willing to help you increase, you know, your success at three-point shots. What's the kind of squad size in a basketball team? And is there in basketball, do you think, is there more of that kind of one-to-one coaching maybe goes on?
So the way it worked, depending on what teams I was on, but in Spain they were very, very good at that. So what tend to happen in the Spanish leagues was you would have your head coach, and then your assistant coaches were usually made up of junior coaches who worked with the junior teams.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
After every session with our senior team, there was always these individual workout sessions, and it would be the junior coach usually working them. So when I talked to my head coach, he would always say to me, you know, I tried to have him come to some of my camps in Scotland, and he would say to me, well, I'm not the best coach. And I'm thinking, you're a national team coach, you coach in Valencia, you're a great coach. But the way he sees himself is, he's a great manager.
Yeah.
He's good at managing egos, managing this. If you want a good coach, a skills coach, these are the guys you go for. So what he did was, he worked on my mindset with me, but then he assigned me with a lot of the junior coaches to work on my certain technical skills.
Okay.
And that's even to have the self-awareness as a coach to say things like that. He's at the highest level to say, well, actually, there's better coaches than me. That just shows you the Spanish philosophy. You know, and I really see the Spanish system, especially, was all about teaching. They were great teachers, and actually most of them came from a teaching background, so because it worked perfectly with the seasons. Because they'd get the summers off, and that's when a lot of the national team basketball would be on. So they'd be, you know, they're either lecturers, professors, teachers. And I think those skill sets as well really enhance, because when you can help people learn, that goes back to, you know, you're talking about that game intelligence. It's the learning aspect of that. And so I, you know, having him have the faith in me to like I said, sit me aside, do a few extra like video sessions and so forth. But I was also working on that 3-point shot with his blessing to work on that. Mm-hmm. Then he actually adapted that into some of the plays that were ran for me in the games because it became so successful. So it just I don't think that was his initial vision of what I was supposed to do. But my game evolved so quick just because of the work I was putting in.
Yeah. The work that's been put in there, but also, as Kieran touched on earlier, Greg, his willingness to learn and adapt and take it on, and a hunger to do that as well. I just want to bring up to the point where Kieran mentioned there, you know, a good leader or a good manager knows probably where his weaknesses lie. And I think that's something we spoke about before, isn't it, Greg, that a coach can be able to say, actually, no, learn from him or and surround himself with the best possible people in those areas.
Yeah, it's that kind of old adage, is never be the smartest person in the room yourself, and having that ability, as Kieran said, you know, to I suppose self-reflect and realise what your strengths are, and then bring in other people to complement that even more so. And that's the sign of a good coach, as Kieran said, you know, and a good, you know, that'll form a good management team to hopefully bring the team on to success.
But there's one thing I a lot of people fail to, you know, everyone always talks about the leader. So we go on about leadership, and every single player that I've ever played for wants to be a leader in some way. Yeah. And, you know, I've been very fortunate to coach nearly, to captain every team I've played on, essentially. But what I'm saying is the best leaders are also the best followers.
Yeah.
So if you learn to follow and you become a good follower, so you take pride in following, mm-hmm. listening to your coach, actively listening, being able to critique and challenge in a certain way that's not, you know, going to be the detriment of the team. It's thinking about the collective. These are things that people tend to neglect. Everyone always pushes this whole leadership. But followership is just, if not more, important, because a leader is nothing without its followers. So I think that my coach in Spain, especially Jaume, he understood that you talk about that willingness to learn. He understood that I was willing to follow because I was hungry. You know what I mean? I wanted to be better. But then it's that trust factor that then has to come in. Well, a lot of people tend to neglect that because they think they already know it or whatever. Or they're already thinking about the next this, or I'm playing the Olympics, you're not going to help me this. You know, it's thinking about how can you utilise that situation and actually be able to pick up things from people, you know. That's a tough thing.
Is it fair to say then you were more of a, I know what you're saying with the followership, but is it a critical thinker as well, rather than just following for the sake of following? Or the gaffer said that, therefore that's what I must do. You know, is there a bit of critical thinking in there, as you say, you know, question and answer with the manager in that way that helps the following?
I compare it to you go for your bachelor's degree and then you go and do your master's, right? So mm-hmm. before you start doing that whole critical thing, I think you kind of have to have a base. So that's the learning aspect. So my early days in my career, I'm not challenging anybody. I'm just soaking everything up.
Yeah.
And then once I get to the point that I'm looking at different reads and looking at different this, and then I started having that kind of coaching kind of mindset, that's when I started to critique. That's when I started to ask more of the whys. Mm-hmm. Really kind of pick up on things and challenge a certain way. And like I said, different coaches I worked with, you can challenge them in different ways. Some you could never do it in front of the rest of the group. Some you'd have to go to the office. Some of them you would say something and they get very defensive, and you know, you just kind of accept your role then. So it's understanding your relationships as well, because everyone always, I see, especially now in the game, we're talking about everyone's in this great kind of bubble and you can challenge in a certain way. And even from a coaching perspective, you have them say, you know, it's a two-way conversation. But the reality is, when you play professional, not every coach is like that. And if you say something, right, that could be your job. Yeah. You know what I mean? So the best way for me is that whole emotional intelligence piece. It's understanding your environment. So my goal was, no matter who I had in front of me, what coach, what players, whoever I was with, I was going to be able to adapt to get the best out of that situation. You know, and that's being able to control the controllables. And that's, again, emotional intelligence is so underrated, but it's probably one of the most important keys you can have. Understanding how other people think and understanding how other people work will enhance what you do and how you can relay your message over to other people.
Yeah. That's valid, not just for sport, isn't it, in terms of life?
That's just life. And I'm learning that now. Definitely, even life after sport.
Yeah. It's incredible hearing what I tend to do when I'm doing these podcasts, I'll take a few notes in terms of things I want to talk about. But when you said they're the best leaders, they're the best followers, that's something I've taken note of just for me, for thinking about that as I kind of progress in my career. And that is
definitely a two-way street, you know.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's a really good point to make, Greg, isn't it? That way of having that approach to things. And it's clearly that Kieran's picked that up through his career, and particularly when he talks about his learnings in Spain.
Yeah, and it's, I'm back to that kind of open-mindedness again, that it's important that, that players have that, you know, and it's not just, you know, turn up to training, train, go home, don't think about things. And, you know, we've spent a lot of time, Lewis, now on these podcasts during kind of lockdown, speaking to, you know, people like Kieran that have played professional sport. And, you know, the sounds of it, they've all been good reflectors or critical thinkers, as I've maybe recently said. And it's, you know, we've talked to people that are pretty damn successful in their own right. And you know, whether that be, you know, a Steve Salas and kind of, you know, mentoring people throughout sport, or Kieran now, or a Marvin Bartley, or whoever else it's been. But they've all had that ability, I think. And that's all come across in those last three or four episodes.
It has. It's been really fascinating to listen to. I think I want to kind of move shortly from your playing career and the coaching side of things to obviously the work that you're doing in mental health at the moment, Kieran. But before we get to that, I guess, just for purely from my interest point of view, that moment with the Olympics, when you are in the team and you're, you know, it all gets started, is there a moment of self-reflection there where you look back on your career, or you start to get thankful for things, or are you purely the type of, no, next step?
So I actually was helping someone with a dissertation the other day talking about this. So when the Olympics finished, I was angry. Because what had happened was my goal was to make the Olympics. And I made the Olympics. But then I never thought about what I wanted to do when I'm in the Olympics and trying to get to that next level. But at the same time, it was a gift and a curse, because I was like a right fanboy. I'm, you know, going up to Mo Farah, getting photos. You know, I've got a photo with Ryan Giggs and stuff. And actually, I got Craig Bellamy to take the picture. And it was just, I was just in awe. I was, you know, in this village with all these amazing athletes. And I was, you know, I love to ask questions. I'm asking them how they started their careers, how they get this. So I was just soaking up all this kind of information. But I wasn't thinking about the games, you know. And then when it was over, I was thinking, we didn't, you know, if we'd beaten Australia, we'd have made the next round. And that would have been our funding taken to, you know, it's cutthroat UK sport. We went from X amount of millions to zero. And that's essentially UK sport saying, you're worthless. We don't believe in you, you know.
Yeah.
And that's how I took that. So I was angry at myself because I didn't give it my absolute all. I was angry because I had so much fun and I was so excited and enjoyed that moment. But I'm thinking, have I ruined this for the next generation? Does that make sense? Like, is that going to be it? And then I was angry because I'd worked so hard to get to this point, and I feel like I just kind of wasted it. You know what I mean? So I had this kind of anger kind of side. But then when I came back and we had the, you know, the parade and everything like that, I was proud, you know, and that's when I ended up, you know, got the Olympic rings tattoo and stuff, because I had to then reflect. And I was thinking, I was just this wee big boy from Brayheath, and I've just made the Olympic Games in a sport that I didn't even know about until I was like 14, 15, you know. So I felt that, okay, I've now been given a platform. I've done something that a lot of people could only dream about. Now how do I then utilise that and use that to the next thing? And that, you know, that whole inspired a generation thing became really, really serious. I took that really, really seriously. And my goal was, I understand the percentage of people who actually play basketball, not even basketball, just sport in general at a professional level is very slim. But what's to stop someone being successful in anything? And that's kind of like my kind of way of looking at it. I'm not siloed at all when I talk to people. It's all about developing for success, and that could be put in any single situation. And that's what kind of drives me. That's what my purpose is now in life.
Yeah, that's sort of feels like an incredibly round picture we're starting to get here, Greg, isn't it, of the impact that this career in sports had on Kieran as a guy?
Unbelievable, yeah. And it's you know, it just goes to show that probably the work, or it reflects the work he's doing now, and the work that maybe wants to go in. And I suppose you'll get into that a little bit more, Lewis. But you know, he's got so much to offer there. You know, from the career he's had in basketball, yeah.
I guess now is a good a time as any, Kieran, to touch about the work that you're doing in mental health. I know that, you know, health is the priority at the moment, but I think people are appreciating the importance of looking after your mental health at times when there's these challenges on everybody's plate at the moment. So, you're doing a lot of work in that environment, I know.
Yeah, and that kind of stumbled. Well, I was quite proactive, I would say, but I went back to university my last year of playing to do a master's in leadership and management. And it was actually at the time it was to help me become a better captain. That was my kind of mindset. But quickly changed into something else. I realised that there was a lot of I was getting out of it. But my dissertation was on the athlete transition. Okay. Out of sport, and I always laugh at this because it wasn't education to me, it was therapy. Yeah. I was now, because I knew I was going to embark on this, and in my mind I'd been preparing it for a few years, but what does that actually mean and what did it look like? So when I started interviewing a lot of athletes, it was all basketball players, but talking about their journeys from playing to after sport, it inspired hope in me. Because I was hearing, okay, they've done this, and they had this, and they had that, and I just felt so much better that I can go through this, and life after sport, you can just have as much success, and you might not have this, I might not have that, but there's other avenues, even advice that was given to me about making sure that you stay physically active, making sure you stay connected, because your support mechanisms are going to completely drop. So for me, like my sports psychologist, team doctor, my coaches, people I'd speak to, the group chat was gone. Like it's literally, you're not in that anymore. And there's no point in you being in it because it was things like, be here for this time, be here for that time. But you just see this and you're like, okay, what's going on? So from a mental health perspective, I saw this company called Frog Systems. I knew the CEO there. And I went to speak to him and I saw what they're doing. They're using video of people who went through social issues, for example, gambling, yeah, drug addiction, sure, alcohol abuse, domestic violence. And it's people speaking up, champions, we'd say, it's the champion cinema, talking about these issues and talking about hope, coming out the other end. But the main point was they then signpost support, so it's local support to you. So I saw this and I was thinking, how powerful could this be in sport? Yeah. Because there's athletes who are going through so many things, from depression to anxiety to gambling, and everyone says we've got these phone lines, we can contact this and contact that, and I get it, but not everyone's going to do that because in their minds are thinking, if I can't, they might not play me at the weekend or whatever.
Yeah,
but I was thinking if you could show people, kind of destigmatize the area, so you have people who are speaking up on their experiences, who they relate to you, they're athletes themselves. And then you're also talking about the external supports to them, not just internally that the SFA are offering, but externally to their local area, that they know it's going to be anonymous and everything. It just might help them push them through that edge. So that's been my goal over the last year. I'm really, really kind of, again, like saying, finding my purpose. But that's for me, that's for young people as well. People talking about in school, from self-harm to all these different social issues. But the thing is, I've started to do the interviews now, and I had Aaron Connolly share his story with us a month ago. It's just so powerful. And my thing is, these are the kind of stories you have to hear, because my goal is to help people be a little bit more proactive. You're not waiting to the last second till they're actually thinking about actually ending their lives. What can we do? What kind of coping strategies can we learn early on how to deal with certain things? So for me, my example was my last year playing, the online trolling really affected me. And when I say online trolling in basketball, there's maybe three or four people going at you, right? Mm-hmm. I did that Scottish Cup draw and I looked at the stuff that was said. I was thinking, football is a completely different beast, And, the advice you're always given as a player, don't look at it. Like, that's not going to happen. I guarantee most players who are saying, it just bounces off me. Well, maybe bounce off them today. But when you're in a vulnerable state, you don't know when that might be. What are you then going to do? You know what I mean? And it's not a battle between, I'm strong, I'm strong-minded, I'm strong. Like, because everyone has little lapses and little moments that they're not as strong as they first thought they were. Yeah. And for me, I think it was as an aging player, I started to question my abilities a little bit more. So then I was letting outside influences affect me a little bit more. And that started to play in my mind. So I had to get that under control. And that was my reasoning for retiring.
Yeah, God, it's a really powerful story when you hear it, Greg, but it's something that needs to be spoken about more and more. I know at the Scottish FA we're doing a little bit more on that
front.
I think it is something that needs to continue to grow and develop, doesn't it, as overall, not just football, not just basketball society?
I think it is, and it's only through, as Kieran says, people sharing those powerful stories that that'll be able to happen. It was, I don't know if I'm speaking out of turn here or not, but it maybe has been kind of swept under the carpet for a while, particularly this country. You hear all these phrases in Scotland, like, oh, just man up, just go on with it. And that's unfortunately no longer good enough. People do, as Kieran says, they do need that little bit of help and support at times, and a friendly face, and somebody like Kieran who's perhaps trained in the right area. As you say, Lewis, we've got a good, we've got the Doc, John McLean and Katie Stewart and Carrie McCrae and all these guys at the Scottish FA that can help us and input to our education system now. So no, those support networks are critical.
It must be, as much as there's so many challenges that comes with that, Kieran, there must be points where it feels rewarding as well when you see the impact that you can have on people.
And that's what I'm saying. Everyone talks about, oh, you're such a good guy now. But I get a lot out of that as well. And that's the thing. That's the win-win. We always talk about giving back. When giving back makes you feel good, that's one of your coping strategies. So a lot of people like to give for that reason, because it makes them feel good. I've realised through my work what I've done. I've played professional basketball. I've seen the world. I had a lot of purpose in that. I just couldn't go to something that has no purpose. So what I realised was I played one season in Bulgaria and I made really good money, but the competition had dropped drastically and I just wasn't enjoying it. And I was thinking to myself, I'm making all this money and I'm not happy. So that's when I realised that I need something. So when I came back to Scotland after Bulgaria, I was making a fifth of the money I was making, working two jobs, doing this, doing that. But I had more purpose in my life. So that's where I kind of see I need a balance. Don't get me wrong, financially I need to be at a certain point. Sure. But I also need to have that purpose. Without that purpose, we've talked about Simon Sinek and start with the why. I need to have that. And I know I go looking for that. So everything I align myself to at this moment in time, there is some type of purpose that kind of aligns with my values,
Yeah. Don't know about you, Greg, but it hasn't impacted me when I hear that and I think about that myself. And for when I know that we formed this podcast for the benefit of the coaching world, but it feels like the more we do this, and particularly this episode in itself, there's so many more lessons that transcend sport, coaching, whatever, that it is a pleasure to listen to.
No, absolutely. And even just, Kieran kind of finished his last, what he was last chatting there about, the start with why. And he's mentioned that throughout, the Simon Sinek book, he's talked about the why throughout, the last 40 minutes or so, or however long we spoke. And as you say, it transcends so many different ways of life. We have our Pride Labs in at the Scottish FA. The Pride Labs are for the heads of children, heads of youth, heads of goalkeeping. And bringing them together to discuss, and we just spent a whole day once talking about, let's start with why here. Why are you all in that role to be a head of children, head of youth, head of goalkeeping? What's your why? And really looking into that stuff that Kieran's talking about, so that they've got a purpose. They've got their purpose. They might have 12 coaches in that head of youth area. They might have 12 or so coaches they've got to manage, but those 12 or so coaches have got another 20 players each. What is the why? Is it about them? Is it about the players? It could be about so much, but that purpose, as Kieran says, I think is critical.
Yeah, I guess then, and I'm conscious of how long we could talk about all of this, Kieran, but the next steps for you then, mate, what's your kind of future looking like? I know obviously amid the shutdown it's hard to kind of put a finger on what the next steps are, but that purpose, that drive, I'm sure will be pushing you on right through.
Yeah, definitely. And that's just something over the last, like I said, since I retired last May, there was still that shock factor because I didn't know exactly what I wanted to do. See, when you're black, 6'9", people tell you to play basketball, right? They don't say, be a CEO, be this, be that. So it has become a lot harder. It's been a learning curve for me. It's a lot of networking, talking to people. Yeah. Like I said, I'm now starting to go back to my early days in my career. And just soaking up information, listening to many people as possible. There have been so many coffee meetings and just listening to people's stories, how they got to here, how they got there. And my mind has been all over the place. But like I said, I'm driven right now by that kind of purpose, about that whole development factor, things that I'm doing. It's all about the greater good and helping people, because people get behind that. People will support you if you're thinking about a more holistic approach to things. So I don't know exactly what I want to do. I just know that that mental health piece is something that's really I'm really passionate about. So I'm going to find a way to push that. No matter how it looks, that's going to be pushed. And then secondly, I want to do it. I still want to be involved in the whole development aspect of things. So I've been working with Switch to Play as well, which goes and delivers kind of talks about, you know, life after sport. And I've really enjoyed that. I think it's such a powerful tool to kind of get into that kind of grasp. But the thing I've realised with that is that you can't leave it until later on. That has to be talked about and implemented at a young age. And the way I think that the realisation what I've got from that is younger players, it's not about, there's no point in talking about life after sport. You have to talk about how you can better them now. And my goal is by bettering them now, the byproduct will be preparation for them for life after sport. So it's working out how best to kind of pitch that. Because I know that if you improve, you know, you say better people make better athletes. I wholeheartedly believe that. So how do we make people better now? And one of the ideas I had was this kind of transferable skills thing of getting coaches to kind of write down the skill sets that they would look into the ideal player. And I guarantee it would be good communication skills, resilient, this. And then you look at a CV for a job outside of sport, it'll be the exact same skill sets.
Yeah.
So are we taking them seriously enough? Or are we really just focusing on that talent that we say people have? Because you understand that talent itself is not, it's not sustainable. You know, it'll only get you so far. That longevity, you need to have all those soft skills to go along with it. So it's working on those soft skills, which also help for athletes after sport.
When you talk about soft skills, Kieran, and listening to your story, how many languages can you speak?
Two.
I just thought you were the type of person that's been to all these countries. You would probably be fluent in about half a dozen languages. You know,
it's funny. So when I first moved to Italy, I clung on to the Americans because that was my comfort zone.
Yeah,
my second year that it started to change, but then I moved to Sicily, and Sicily was a completely different dialect. I could not understand anything. So then, when I moved to Italy to Spain, I started taking Spanish lessons, and I was laughing because everyone always said, "Oh, the big guy, he's always speaking Italian to us." They were too similar. Yeah. When I went to Greece, I just gave up. Greece and Bulgaria, I had absolutely no chance. So, yeah. But that's actually something I've just signed up for. I've signed up to go back, and I'm going to take another course in Italian to do it more formally, because it's informal. I sound like a 3-year-old child talking.
Speak
Italian, but I know every swear word you could, because I got called them all when as a player. So, it's something that, like I said, from a personal development side of things, that's something I'm really kind of curious about right now, because I know I've got a good infrastructure. I can pick up my Italian, I can pick up Spanish very easily.
Yeah. Well, the only word I know in Greek is "kali nikta," which is good night. it's been a complete pleasure, honestly, Kieran, having you on. I've really enjoyed. We could, I think we try to keep them around about an hour long for
people listening.
There'll be people on the end of this thing. No, don't end this when we're just getting started, really. But I think for myself and Greg, just want to thank you very much for coming on the podcast. It's been really a pleasure listening to you.
No, just to say thanks as well, Kieran. It was fantastic to eventually pin you down, I suppose, and get you on. So thanks very much, as Lewis says, yeah.
Well, thanks for having me, and I hope to speak to you guys soon.
That's all we have time for in this week's edition of the Scottish Football Coaching Podcast. Feel free to send us your feedback, your ideas for coaching topics you want us to cover, and to get in touch, visit @ScottishFA on Twitter or email info@scottishfa.co.uk.